Hi, everybody. I'm Carmen LaSalle. Welcome to San Francisco Liberation Radio. On October 12, 2005, Media Alliance hosted an evening at 111 Minna Street in San Francisco dedicated to a discussion of the San Francisco Wireless Initiative. San Francisco is exploring the feasibility of laying fiber optic cables underground at the same time the city sewer system is replaced within the next few years. This would provide an infrastructure for the establishment of an affordable blanket Wi-Fi throughout San Francisco's 49 square miles and help to bridge the digital divide between the middle-class wealthy internet users and those to whom broadband or DSL high-speed connections are unavailable presently. The evening included a speech by law professor Lawrence Lessig of Stanford University and a panel discussion with questions and answers. On the panel sat Dr. Lessig, Dwayne Hendricks, Anna Morales, and Emmy Tseng. The evening finished with a mix-up music provided by two excellent DJs, Kid Chameleon and Ripley. Jeff Perlstein, the executive director of Media Alliance, introduced the speakers and also spoke eloquently about the need for such a Wi-Fi blanket in San Francisco. This is part one of the evening.
A nonprofit called Media Alliance here in the Bay Area. If you've heard of us, please put your hands together, a little quickie. Right on, thank you. Media Alliance is actually on the cusp of its 30th anniversary. It's actually the very first regional media advocacy and activism organization in the U.S., and so the longest running one. So we're really proud to be with you. We're proud to be bringing you these sorts of events, to bring you public dialogue and debate about pressing issues of the day around media and technology, and how they can serve all of us, but particularly making sure that folks who are currently underserved by technology and media really have an opportunity and access to participate actively in our ongoing civic dialogue, civic life, all that sort of stuff. So we're very excited to have all of you here tonight and then some tremendous speakers that I know you're going to enjoy, and I know that's why you're here. Let me quickly just say, too, part of the reason we wanted we put this again together very quickly, because there's a lot of timely things happening. I'm figuring that's probably why you're here. You've heard about them a little bit. So just a quick raise of your hand. If you've heard about what's been going on with the San Francisco Wireless Initiative, just a quick show of your hands, yeah. If you haven't, that's okay, but you're in the right place because you're going to hear more about it tonight. Not just about what's going on in San Francisco, but this is actually a tremendous accelerating development that's happening all around the U.S. and really has been happening all around the world prior to it catching fire here in the States. But we think it's one of the most exciting developments we've seen in a long time, creating opportunities for folks who've currently, you know, been left out of these conversations to really be in the mix, to really be making powerful use of the most powerful, exciting technology we have. And so we're really pleased to be able to present this forum around municipal broadband, also called community internet. San Francisco Wireless, there's all sorts of permutations and versions of what it looks like in different cities and towns. We're going to talk a little bit about some of those complexities tonight, some of the challenges, some of the obstacles, some of the exciting aspects of them, and hope that you leave invigorated, more informed, and also still with some questions in your head, because we're really seeing this as part of an ongoing conversation. One thing we've recognized is that while there's a lot happening here in the Bay Area and nationally around it, there haven't been a whole lot of public forums and public spaces to talk about all that's going on and all the different pieces here, especially in the Bay Area, which is kind of surprising. So we hope that you'll join with us to figure out what are the next conversations, the next steps. We'll talk a little bit about those later in the evening as far as some opportunities for people to stay engaged in this conversation, opportunities to get involved. I'm not going to talk too much further at the moment. I want to introduce our keynote speaker. Many of you know him, and I'm going to give a brief bio. Lawrence Lessig is a professor of law at Stanford Law School and founder of the school's Center for Internet and Society. He's won numerous awards, including the Free Software Foundation's Freedom Award, and was named one of Scientific American's top 50 visionaries for arguing, quote, against interpretations of copyright that could stifle innovation and discourse online. He's the author of Free Culture, The Future of Ideas, as well as Code and Other Laws of Cyberspace. He chairs the Creative Commons Project, serves on the board of the Free Software Foundation, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, the Public Library of Science, and Public Knowledge. He teaches and writes in the areas of constitutional law, contracts, and the law of cyberspace. We're not exactly sure when he finds time to sleep, but we're glad that he's here with all of us and that he's doing this work. We know that all of you are very actively engaged in a lot of this work, so I want to say that up front. This is actually a pretty stacked crowd, so it's an honor to be here again with all of you. And we're looking forward to just give you a sense of the way the evening is going to shape up. We're going to have Professor Lessig speak for about a half hour. Then we're actually going to have three panelists, some more experts come up and give some comments. I'm going to pepper them with a couple questions, have a little bit of back and forth up here. And then we're meanwhile, we'll be passing around cards for you all to write your questions down. Then we'll go to audience Q&A. And then stick around, because at 9, DJs Kid Chameleon and Ripley are going to tear it up on the ones and twos up here. So that should be fun. And please give Professor Lessig a big round of applause and welcome.
So this is a prologue. See, it says it right up here. An argument I want to make that needs an introduction. It's an introduction that needs understanding of a certain context. You could say a page of history, or maybe a slide of history here, is worth 10,000 words. So this history is three stories and then a comparison. And here's the first story. 1921, there was a company called the Hushaphone Company. It made this technology, the Hushaphone. And the Hushaphone attached to telephones. Its purpose was, you might guess, to hush the sound in the room to make the telephone function better. It had no electronics. It was just a piece of metal attached to the phone. Between 1921 and 1948, there was about 150,000 of these sold. And then in 1948, a company called AT&T noticed the Hushaphone out there. And they were upset. And they got the FCC to stop the deployment of this dangerous technology called the Hushaphone. And in a ruling that the Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit gave, they described the FCC's reasoning like this. The use of a Hushaphone affects more than the conversation of its user, that its influence pervades the whole telephone system. And what was its influence? Right? Its influence was that this was innovation that AT&T didn't control. And what did AT&T do? It stopped it. That's story one. Here's story two. 1964, this extraordinary man, Paul Baran, invented a technology while he was working at the Rand Corporation. Rand Corporation was attempting to help the Department of Defense make the world safe for nuclear war. Right? So he developed a technology called packet switching technology, what we would call packet switching technology. A technology to make it so systems of communication could be redundant in case of a war. Now, you might remember, if you know a little bit about history, right? In 1964, the telephone network was owned by a company. That company was called AT&T. And when AT&T heard about this technology, they decided they would stop it. What they said was, first, packet switching technology, of course, the core technology behind the internet, would, quote, never possibly work. And second, they said they would not allow it because, quote, we'll be damned if we allow the creation of a competitor to ourselves. So what AT&T did was fight within the Defense Department, Paul Baran, as he tried to deploy this technology. And at a certain point, Paul Baran realized there was no reason to push, because if AT&T, the monopoly provider of telecom, didn't like this innovation, they were not going to build it in a way that worked. So he put the idea in his drawer, and it wasn't until the 1970s that the idea returned to build the internet. So once again, innovation that threatened the network owner, and the network owner stopped. Final story. So everybody knows about video being streamed to this device, the television. When broadband technology came around, people began to ask the question, what if we could stream video to this device, the computer? Imagine a world where we just didn't get 10 or 15 or 100 channels, but a world where we could have literally an unlimited number of channels, basically any program constantly being streamed to computers. So the question was asked whether the owner of the network would allow this use of the network. And the owner of the largest broadband network at the time was a company called AT&T. And the head of internet services at AT&T at the time, a guy named Daniel Summers, was asked the question, will you permit the streaming of video across your broadband wires to computers? And Daniel Summers, in a moment of honesty, which in this context equates with stupidity, said, we didn't spend $80 billion for a broadband network to, quote, have the blood sucked from our veins. That's translated into, no, we're not going to allow this technology to be used to compete with our own network. Once again, innovation that threatened the network owner, and the network owner tried to use his power to stop. Now, these are three stories that have the same dynamic within them. These are three networks where the owners believe they had the right to control innovation on the network. The innovation within these networks was to be inside the corporation. Inside the corporation, so that the innovation would benefit the network owner. This is a world where innovation was owned, and it produced certain kinds of innovation. Basically, innovation that benefited the existing network. Now, why was it like this? Well, the innovation was like this because the network owners constantly said they need it to be like this. Otherwise, it's not economically worth it for them to invest the money in the networks that they build. So for long times, governments bought this bullshit. For long periods of times, governments allowed networks to control this innovation. And that was the history of telecom for many, many years in this country. So compare this network, these owned networks, with unowned networks. And you're familiar with lots of them, right? For example, innovation networks, where the right to innovate is not owned by the network owner. Here's a very simple example. The electricity grid, right? What is the electricity grid? It's a network. Somebody owns the network, but the owner of the network does not get to say which innovation is allowed on that network. If you comply with the protocols, you can plug whatever you want into this network, and it will run just as well as anything else. It's not a network where a Sony television set has more static than a Panasonic television set because the owner of the network has decided to cut a deal with Sony or Panasonic rather than with the other. It's a network where everything runs in the same way. It's a neutral network. At its core is a principle of neutrality. Or here's another neutral network, right? The highway system, which is built to accept all cars, all comers, within a certain set of protocols. It was built, of course, largely with public funding. We could have imagined a different way of funding this network. Right? Imagine Eisenhower had called up the head of GM and said, look, if you want to build the interstate highway system, go ahead. You can build it. And if you build it and pay for it, then you can make it so that only GM trucks run on this highway system. Right? That's a possible way to imagine the highway system being built, but it would be insane because we have a principle that we all understand about how these networks are to be neutral among competitors. But most important is this network called the internet, fundamentally designed to be a neutral network in a way I'm going to describe in a second, but I want you to think a little bit about the product of this neutrality. Think about the innovations, some of the most important innovations in the history of this network, right? So the original network itself is thought up by Bob Kahn and Vint Cerf, who at least one of them at the time is properly called a kid, basically a graduate student who was employed to sit down and write a bunch of protocols. or the World Wide Web, invented by a researcher at CERN lab in Switzerland, or ICQ, the first peer-to-peer chat protocol, right? Invented by an Israeli kid, and then he and his father turned it into a company they sold to AOL for $400 million. Or Hotmail, HTML mail, invented by an Indian immigrant to the United States, which he then turned into a company that he sold to Microsoft for the magic $400 million. Or Napster, invented by a bunch of BU undergraduates sitting in their dorm room, deciding how best to architect distribution of music. Now, what is it that's common about these innovators? It is that all of these innovators of some of the most important innovations in the history of the network are either kids or non-Americans. Outsiders from this network. Right? Outsiders of the network who had the right to innovate, and it is no accident here that this produced some of the most important innovation that the network saw, because these innovators didn't have in their mind, how do I make the network work for the network owner? They had in their mind, how do I make the network work for people who use the network? They lived a principle, which network architects call the end-to-end principle, E to E. A principle which says all innovation in this network should essentially happen at the edge of the network, or as much as possible. The owner of the network should not control this innovation. Instead, innovation is as users will want. And it's this design that's responsible for the extraordinary explosion of innovation that occurred around the internet and some of the most important innovation in the context of digital network technologies, end to end, embracing a principle of neutrality. Now, when the internet first started taking off in the early 1990s, that principle of end-to-end neutrality was firm. Indeed, in the narrowband world, telecoms, dial-up world, the principle was mandated by law. Because after AT&T fell out of favor with government regulators in 1984, the Reagan administration broke it up and regulated it in a way that guaranteed that its couldn't control the innovation that happened on top of it, so that great new ideas like the internet could take off without the network owner deciding it would stop this innovation. So in the 1990s, we saw this principle flourish into what we understand the internet to be. But then this principle fell under a threat. Right, there it is, principle under threat, as broadband technologies took off. Because as broadband networks became part of this debate, they started saying a familiar slogan. It's our network. Our network, which means we get to decide who runs what on it. Indeed, the cable companies are the primary articulators of this view. That's because cable companies have always got to decide what runs on their network. So when it came to IP, they had the same idea in their head. We get to decide. So the question was, will you respect these principles of neutrality? And slowly the rhetoric began to emerge from these network owners. We can't. We can't respect this neutrality. If we respect this neutrality, we can't afford to build the network. You've got to give us the right to own innovation on this network. You've got to give us the right to control how it develops, otherwise we can't afford to build it. We must be able to discriminate, or we can't build this network. Okay, so that's point one. This is going to be the second part. I didn't lose count, right? So that was the prologue. I guess this is the log, all right? So there's been an explosion of activity among municipalities across the country. Most interestingly, in very conservative areas, like Utah has some of the most innovative thoughts around municipalities participating in broadband distribution. And these municipalities are increasingly hearing the telecoms say, we can't afford it, And they're responding with, okay, let us help. After all, what you are building is infrastructure. Infrastructure. So let us help build it. It's infrastructure, meaning it's the sort of stuff that supports not just commercial activity, but social and political and cultural activity. It's infrastructure that will sufficiently be provided only if the government plays a role in helping to support its provision. So help us supply it, and especially in the context of wireless infrastructure, where whatever the telecom and cable companies say about all the money they invested in building the wires that connect our houses together, the one thing that's for sure is that AT&T didn't build spectrum. Nature built spectrum, gave it to us for free. And so what municipalities are increasingly saying is, let us use nature to help build this infrastructure. Now notice the old argument, if we can't own it, we won't be able to build it, doesn't work anymore. We don't need you to build it. It's there. So this has inspired a new argument. It has a long version, a complicated version, an academic version. Here's the short version. This is just communism. Communism, right? And the attackers of communism, I'm sorry, that's not him. For example, Governor Rendell of Pennsylvania, who's become the strong anti-communist fighter, have increasingly responded to this communist threat by legislating against it. So in Philadelphia, there was a project to build wireless in Philadelphia because the vast majority of the poorest regions in Philadelphia could not buy broadband at any price. So Philadelphia said, we're going to enter the 21st century by having universal access to broadband. And the communist threat was realized in Harrisburg, and Governor Rendell, telecom toady, rallied the troops to fight it. And he fought it by legislating a ban. Of course, Philadelphia was pretty powerful, so it was a ban on all areas except Philadelphia. A ban against municipal wireless. A ban which more than 14 states around the country have now adopted to stop municipal wireless from competing with the incumbent telecoms. Now, what's the principle behind the ban? Well, it goes something like this. If the market can provide it, however poorly, then the government shouldn't provide it at all. Simple principle. Let's see how it applies to the rest of the world. So, for example, think about this technology. Streetlights. Free photons. The government gives away free photons, running out of business the private lighting companies that could exist to provide exactly this same technology, right? Or this technology, public buses competing constantly with taxis, right? Or this, public highways making it impossible to run a good toll road system anymore, right? These are all examples of this principle. If the market can do it, the government shouldn't do it at all. Now, of course, this principle, when understood like this, is just absurd. Right? It's absurd because we all recognize, again, there is a place for infrastructure, and if we didn't recognize it 2 months ago, we recognize it today. There is a place for government in helping to guarantee the proper infrastructure is in place for the full range of our citizens, not just those who can afford cars to escape hurricanes, but for all of our citizens. That's the government's role, and that is exactly the role that Jefferson imagined for governments when he imagined them building libraries, and Jefferson was no communist. So the principle here is a principle is as old as this republic, yet for some reason now we've forgotten it. Well, let's remember it again. If they can't build these networks neutrally, if they say it's impossible, fine. Tell them to get the hell out of the way. Tell these network owners to allow others to do it. Because what's happening here is extraordinarily important to the future, not just of the rich in these countries around America, but to Americans in this country around America. We are now at least 13th in the world. Someone told me this is worse, 15th now, but 13th in the world in broadband penetration. Right? 13th in the world, right? And the broadband we have is insanely expensive and slow. Now, you can be an academic theorist about which system works best. Forget the academics. Let's look practically at the facts. The private market alone here has failed. And the solution to this failure is not communism. The solution is that we just simply don't let the market do this alone. We recognize, as with every other infrastructure project we've ever had, there is a role. It's not a role to own and manage in the way the Soviets might have. But it is a role to support. Support to the extent we know the private market wouldn't. So that's what's extraordinarily important about this experiment here. An experiment to provide cheap, fast, ubiquitous broadband connectivity across this whole city. Now, it's absolutely right that this city pursue this idea. It's absolutely right we do it now before the telecom companies convince another 36 states to make it illegal. It's extraordinarily important we do it now, but we have to do it consistent with certain principles. And these principles sum up to one single word, neutrally. So the first implementation of the neutral principle is that a government gets involved and doesn't muck about with the content. It's a content-neutral network. And the second principle involved is that it's a platform-neutral network. It's wrong for the city of San Francisco to license this technology out to a company that requires you use a Windows machine to get access to the network or a Mac machine to get access to the network. This network must be accessible from every single major platform, especially the GNU Linux operating system. And third, this network must embrace the founding principle of what made this internet function, the end-to-end principle of neutrality. It must embrace it, and if it does, it will radically change the nature of the debate, which is going on around the country and especially in Washington right now about the future of the network. Because everywhere interests have organized, they have organized most strongly against this picture of neutrality and the innovation that builds everywhere. But if cities like San Francisco succeed in changing the debate by actually building networks that show something different, show access that cuts across neighborhoods, that cuts across economic boundaries, then that practical demonstration will radically change the way broadband gets deployed across this country. It will make the future of the network much like its past, neutral and vigorous and extraordinarily important. Okay, so here's a final point, right? We need to recognize something extremely important about this debate. It has nothing to do with network architectures. It has nothing to do with end-to-end principles. The important thing about this debate is to recognize the certain kind of bravery involved in those government officials that decide to push something like Muni wireless or Muni broadband access. Telecoms spend about $1 billion a year in lobbying. It's the cheapest thing in the world for a politician to become a telecom toady. All the money in the world chases politicians as they try to make a decision about what's right. And it's very easy in this climate for people to be backed into the position that makes it sound like the only way consistent with the values of America is to sell our soul to the telecom companies. Now, this takes a certain amount of courage and support from communities to make sure that politicians who decide to do the right thing here don't suffer the consequences from doing what they do. So as we debate how best these politicians should do it, the first thing we should assert again and again and again is that what they are doing deserves our praise. Because in this climate, it is extraordinarily important to say the most obvious and simple truths. So here first, our celebration here should be about what they have done by opening this debate up, not just in the most conservative states of Utah, but also here, where, of course, it's appropriate. We understand that though we are not communists, we understand that there are values more important than selling the future to those who decide how the future should develop. We understand those values here. And if we can embed this experiment with the support, political support it requires, then others elsewhere will have the same courage too. And we can change this debate and make it possible for a politician once again to say, maybe there's a role for government. Maybe not everything, but maybe there's a role. And that as good as we've become at delivering private goods to rich people, maybe we could become half as good in delivering public goods to our nation. Thank you very much.
Thank you. So now we're going to segue. I'm going to make some brief introductory comments to introduce our esteemed panelists. We're going to tease out the conversation a little bit more, and we'll keep doing that throughout the rest of our time. First of all, bravo, yes, to the folks who are here. All of you, well, you're going way back into the hall there. So hi, everyone. That's great. And it's especially great because, as we were saying, this is actually one of the first public discussions and spaces around this very dynamic, timely, and important initiative. So we're hoping it will be, again, one of many to come. And also that it will spur action and engagement, not just talk. What I wanted to raise is a few questions that our panelists are going to help us deepen the conversation some and take it a little further. And I want to put them out there. First, I want to say, not to pat ourselves on the back, but just to say a little bit about Media Alliance's history with some of this work. We actually were involved a number of years ago, before I was here, actually in 2000, with a number of community-based organizations, other media and public interest advocates, in a fight called the Open Access Fight, which was a related fight, which was making sure that these weren't just proprietary networks, that they actually were open to independent service providers, so that there was competition, choice, all sorts of space for all sorts of engagement online. The Open Access Fight has largely been shut down, unfortunately, and now we largely have a choice of two large companies if you want high-speed internet. You either have Comcast to deal with, you have SBC to deal with. So over the years since then, Media Alliance had really been pushing for other alternatives. We've been looking internationally across the country, and it's seen the growth of these municipal networks, community networks as well. And we've been working closely with some of the friendlier elected officials, specifically Supervisor Amiano, who I want to make sure is really mentioned in all these conversations, because the mayor has gotten a lot of props and he's taken some risks here. But it's really Supervisor Amiano who pushed this conversation way early on. And we actually were part of the conversation with him to put forward the idea of a municipal broadband network. We spoke at the press conference, helped them come up with some of those key points. This was before wireless was really happening quite so much. The idea was that when the city goes ahead and tears up the streets to redo their sewer system, they should also take a couple minutes to lay some really big fat fiber in there. Because the cost of actually deploying this stuff is not in the fiber itself, although that's expensive, but it's in the trouble and expense to tear up all the streets. So since the city was going to do it anyway, the proposal was, well, let's put this in here and have a real backbone, a real infrastructure that's independent of these two big companies, this duopoly. So this has evolved over time, and to his credit, the mayor and his folks and other folks in City Hall have helped put forward this initiative. So we want to support that notion of universal, affordable access, a neutral network, all these sorts of pieces. We also want to lend some critical perspective and ask some critical questions, because the devil's in the details here. It can look a lot of different ways. And mapping neutral, equal sorts of conversations onto the landscape where there's lots of inequality doesn't make everything equal. And so that's one of the things we have to really raise, is that there's lots of, there still is a digital divide even here in San Francisco, this very wired city. There's communities that today, even if folks put down the cash on the table, that SBC and Comcast will not come and provide DSL or broadband service to your neighborhood because it doesn't fit their business model. So there's a real need for these independent networks, these municipal networks, to provide some competition and to provide faster, less expensive access. Last point I want to make is to raise the question and make the point, is providing a ubiquitous, free or very low cost wireless hotspot over the whole city, is that going to help us really bridge the digital divide for folks who don't have, for example, computers in their house, who don't have a computer with a wireless card in their house, who don't have the training necessarily to know how to access that wireless network? So this is one of the concerns that we've been raising and want to continue to put out there, which isn't to say that this isn't an important initiative and it shouldn't go forward, but can we make sure it's as good as possible, that it's really making sure that there's not just universal access, a cloud floating around, but there's universal usage, that everyone in San Francisco is able to actually make use of this great resource, this great benefit. And so even, I won't say even, but in the mayor's own remarks, he acknowledged that the access piece of getting the cloud up and running is actually just the first of four key pillars. There's a Group One Economy that's done a lot of work around this. We've done a lot of work around this conversation. Some of the folks you're gonna hear tonight have really been pushing this issue here and around the world. Is that that cloud is one piece, but it doesn't bring it home to people's living rooms. It doesn't allow their kids necessarily to make use of this, so it benefits them in their schooling, in their economic development, in civic life, cultural life. So there need to be three other components that have been talked about. The second one being, you need to have hardware. You need to have the computers and the wireless card to really bring this thing into your household. Secondly, is you need to have training, free or low-cost training, as far as how to make the best use of it, how to have it be secure, all these other questions. And then fourth, the people need to have resources. There needs to be content that's relevant to them and their communities that makes them want to be engaged in the conversation. So it's not just them being passive consumers of what's being pumped out to them, but they're actively having a two-way or multi-way conversation that really realizes the opportunity and potential of the internet, of these networks. So training and resources for media and content production. So those pieces we're really interested and concerned about. Philadelphia, actually, I actually was going to call this talk, subtitle it, Catching Up with Philadelphia. Because Philadelphia hasn't just really been out front as far as the access piece, but they've woven in these other aspects into their RFP, their request for proposals. And it's worth mentioning they actually just issued the bid to a company that's not Google. And we're really glad that Google, you know, has gotten a lot of splash around this and elevated the conversation. And we hope that we'll continue to have the conversation with Google and other folks. There were 22 other bids that went in. And one of them was by Earthlink, who just won the bid in Philadelphia. And so Philadelphia said, we're going to figure out a way not just to put this cloud around, but to meet these other three pillars as part of this process and this project. So we want San Francisco at least to live up to as good as Philadelphia has, if not better. And that's part of the conversation we hope to tease out a little bit more as we move forward. I'm going to wrap up my comments, and I'm going to start introducing our panelists. First, I'm going to give you their three names. Then I'm going to have them come up. They're going to give about 5-minute introductory remarks on pieces that they bring to this. And as I said before, then I'm gonna kind of pepper them with some questions. And meanwhile, we're gonna have these cards going around where you all can write down some questions. So if I can find the bio sheet that I had, yes.
this concludes part one of San Francisco Liberation Radio's broadcast of the Media Alliance sponsored evening dedicated to information about the San Francisco Wireless Initiative. The Media Alliance website is www.media-alliance.org. San Francisco Liberation Radio is a 24/7 internet radio station found at www.liberationradio.net. Thank you for listening. This is Carmen LaSalle.